This is the Sports Illustrated Boxing Podcast.
It's boxing.
A look inside boxing with Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix. Interviews, analysis, and everything going on in boxing. And now a man who I wish was called the Boston Bleeder.
All doctors to the ER.
It's sort of like getting punched in the face.
Chris Mannix.
Hi, welcome back to another episode of the SI Boxing Podcast. Glad you could join me this week because we had a busy weekend of boxing ahead. There are two DAZN shows this weekend, Friday in New York, Saturday in Southern California. You've also got Tyson Fury back in Las Vegas. He returns to the ring for his second fight this year. That fight's going to be on ESPN+. A lot going on, and a lot going on this podcast as well. Lou DiBella, the longtime boxing promoter, he is back. He joins me in studio, and we talk about a whole bunch of different topics. The one-year anniversary of DAZN entering the boxing space is coming up. I get Lou's opinion on what DAZN has been and what it can be moving forward. We also get into the state of women's boxing. Lou has two women on the Friday night card at the theater at Madison Square Garden. Heather Hardy defending her title against Amanda Serrano with a shot at Katie Taylor, likely on the line. Also talk about Anthony Joshua's decision to take the Andy Ruiz rematch to Saudi Arabia. And Tevin Farmer, what's his future coming off a successful run on DAZN? A little bit later on, Devin Haney, 135-pound prospect. He is one step away from potentially fighting for the 135-pound title. He joins me in studio. He's got a big fight coming up Friday night, headlining at the Garden. Just 20 years old, has accomplished a lot in a very short period of time. So stick around. Great podcast. Quick housekeeping note, if you do like this podcast, one easy way you can support it: get over to Apple Podcasts, post a comment, leave a rating. It's simple, it's easy, it's free. It is the very best way to make sure that we keep doing this podcast week after week. That's it. All right, on to my conversation with Lou DiBella. All right, Lou DiBella is back.
I'm fucking back.
On the podcast, President DiBella Entertainment, former HBO executive.
I had to drop that immediately.
Philanthropist, all around good. Philanthropist, all around good guy.
That's the last time I'm going to use the F-bomb, by the way.
Stable genius, as we call him here in the industry. Can I tell you something? One thing that is bizarre about today is, like, you call me, we talk regularly. You talk to other writers regularly. You had someone from your office calling me to ask about where this podcast was taking place and to connect me with you. And you do this every so often. You, like, have someone. Is this because you need them to have to do something in your office? Like,
no, it's because I spend inordinate amounts of time in my car.
You have to, like, go through the process of calling your office and having your office connect to me. You know what it's like? It's like when Kramer gets that assistant on Seinfeld
and calls
Jerry and says, would you like to go to lunch?
But there was a reason for it, actually, because I'm too tightly wound to spend most of my time in the city. So I live on Long Island. So I'm in suburbia. So when I come over here, I'm in the car. I'm a bad enough driver without texting or dialing while I'm driving.
Okay, that's fair.
In fact, most people don't want to get in a car with me when I'm behind the wheel.
That's good to know.
If I was playing with Monopoly money like a lot of people in the industry right now, I'd have a driver, but I'm not in that situation.
Well, how about that industry? And how about that situation? You are part of, I want to get into the women's boxing you have on this show on Friday at the Theater at the Garden, but we are coming up on the one-year anniversary of boxing on DAZN. This is right around September 20th, and there's no question the streaming service has made an impact on the sport.
Well, it's made an incredible economic impact.
Yeah, I mean, collecting some of the top names, spending lavishly on these fights. And the flip side, outside of Canelo, they have not been able to put on the kind of pay-per-view level shows that they have been eager to do. So give me your impressions of the first year of DAZN.
I mean, they're having growing pains, but the quality of the product, if you're a combat sports fan, look, if you're a combat sports fan, you don't have UFC, but Bellator, while there is a gap between UFC, obviously, and Bellator, they are, it's clearly in number two position as an MMA outfit right now. And in combat sports boxing, the quality of the programming on a consistent basis right now on DAZN, a year in, is fairly high quality. If you're a hardcore fan, you need to have DAZN the way at some point in the past you needed to have HBO, you needed to have Showtime. You need to have DAZN if you're that hardcore boxing fan base. The problem we have in boxing, our hardcore fan base isn't enough to sustain a streaming service. So you need to get into that, really, the casual fight fans, the casual combat sports fans, and then you need to open up your portfolio and have other sports. But I think if you're looking at it in terms of overall quality, it's great. Look, there are some things I'll never understand. And again, this is no down on Eddie. Eddie's a great promoter. I mean, Matchroom has a tremendous stable, but they're mostly foreign fighters. They're mostly British fighters, foreign fighters. They have American fighters, but it's also a little strange that when DAZN USA launched, they chose a foreign promoter to be, you know, the anchor, you know. That being said, week in and week out, month in and month out right now, you're getting product that is worth, if you're a combat sports hardcore fan, it's worth your $9 or $10 a month. Mm-hmm. Okay? But there needs to be some, I think, you need some more of those events that are going to move the needle. Mm-hmm. And Canelo, obviously, and Kovalev, there's an awful lot of money is going to be spent on that in an attempt to move the needle. You know, Triple G is here. I've heard that there's still problems and still a reluctance on the part of Canelo to say at any point that he's going to fight Triple G, which has to be very disappointing to the guys running DAZN. I mean, why the whole effort behind bringing Triple G into the fold was to create that you know, mega fight, you know, with Canelo. The Derevyanchenko fight with Triple G is a competitive fight. It's a quality fight. It's certainly a fight that if you're already a DAZN sub and you're a boxing fan, you're going to watch that fight. Mm. You know what I mean? And it's probably also the kind of fight that'll bring in some of those hardcore fans that may not have already subscribed. But the thing about a Triple G Derevyanchenko kind of fight is it's not necessarily the kind of fight that's going to draw a lot of casuals, not really the kind of fight that's going to go outside of that boxing universe. The boxing heads will be receptive, but the overall sports fan, maybe not so much.
Okay, so how do you draw in the overall sports fan? And when you were at HBO, you had a bigger platform, certainly, to promote.
I mean, look, I actually thought there was a tremendous opportunity after the Joshua Ruiz fight to have a mega event. Ruiz was the New York Times cover stories all over the country, late night talk shows, this little fat Mexican American dude upsetting the apple cart, you know, beating the guy that looks like a Greek sculpture. You know, I expected that rematch to take place. Honestly, I really believed it would take place at the Garden or in Vegas or someplace over here. I never would have guessed Saudi Arabia. It's going to be hard to move the needle at the time it's going to be televised. It's a day. It's now what, an early evening, late afternoon kind of event. I mean, that's got to be a major disappointment.
And it probably won't get, you know, not a lot of American media.
Look, it's all about the fucking money. It's happening because a horrible regime looking to clean up its act spent a gazillion dollars to try to clean up their image. Mm-hmm. And clean up, you know, and from a standpoint of Eddie, this wasn't a moral, ethical thing. He went for the money.
Would you have done it?
Probably not. You know what? I would have made it easier. I got to be honest. I've been approached going back almost 30 years from the time I started running, call it 27 years ago, when I started running the boxing program at HBO. There were, going back to that point in time, regimes, not just in the Arab world, but regimes that were looking to do exactly the same thing, that wanted to set up meetings. Can you bring an HBO event there? Can you bring an event there? We didn't take the meetings. You know, it wasn't something we entertained. I've had sort of the same attitude as a promoter. I'm not going to say I've promoted a lot of heavyweight champions since I've been a promoter, but I have had guys that were pay-per-view level fighters and major, major fighters. I have had approaches made. I made it easy. I just didn't take the meeting. Would I have done it here? I don't think so. Honestly, I really don't. But I'm not going to crucify someone or criticize them for doing something that a lot of corporate entities and a lot of people out there are doing. It's a personal decision. It's a matter of conscience. I'm 59 fucking years old, okay? I don't have to do what I don't want to do. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not the kind of guy that flies private jets or does crazy shit or drives a Ferrari. I don't do that kind of shit. So for me, at this point in my life, I make decisions more as to what I'm comfortable with. You know, I got a life right now that if I didn't want to do this much longer, I wouldn't have to. Mm. I mean, I could go run my couple of baseball teams or do what I want to do. I could probably retire fairly soon, not because I'm rolling in dough, but because I'm okay. And I look at things a little bit differently. I don't want to do stuff that's going to make me. There's already enough reasons if you work in combat sports, particularly boxing, where you look in the mirror sometimes and you say, "What the fuck am I doing?" Mm-hmm. And you have a particular meeting or go to a particular event. Or here are the results of a fight that you just watched and the result doesn't match up to what you saw and you feel like taking a really hot shower for a long time, you know? So I try not to do things that don't jive with my own code.
I think the argument you could make, and tell me if you agree with this, about him taking the fight in New York or Las Vegas is that he wouldn't get the pot of money that he got from Saudi Arabia. But if he won in spectacular fashion, I don't know how much value you put on
a lot of value. If he would have come back to the Garden, mm-hmm. and taken care of business in
everyone would have covered it. Every mainstream newspaper, every magazine,
everyone would have covered it. The embracing of the event would have been incredible. In other words, I believe you would have had, you know, most boxing events, unfortunately, we're not getting a lot of print media to the extent there is still print media. You're not seeing sports page cover stories about even the biggest boxing events. If you put would have put Joshua against Andy into the Garden again, I literally believe you would have had cover stories on the back pages of the New York Post, the Daily News, the New York Times sports section. You would have seen major publicity all over the local news. Every media outlet on earth would have been there. And while you would have left money on the table from Saudi Arabia, what Joshua could have done for his image and his earning potential going forward by doing it right here where the first one happened and the world was shocked by his loss, if he would have gotten in there and taken care, I really think that in the long term, you might have gotten that money back. You know, now that being said, taking all the money in Saudi Arabia, there's something in the back of my head that says maybe there's a little bit more uncertainty about the result of the fight on the part of the people making the fight. Mm-hmm. Like, I wonder.
So
like,
take the money and maybe it's a cash out.
If it is a cash out, it's incredible money. Mm-hmm. You know, the money that Joshua is going to make is incredible in that fight. So if it is the last time he fights, which is pop, look, I could absolutely foresee if he were not, I would make him the favorite. I think personally, I would make Joshua the favorite in a rematch. But if he doesn't succeed, if Andy pulls off the second upset, because he's an underdog again, I wouldn't be surprised if that's Anthony Joshua doesn't walk off into the sunset. Mm. And if he does, at least he's walking off with, you know, transformational money. Mm-hmm. Not that he doesn't have it already, but certainly he's going to make the biggest score of his career in this fight. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think a tremendous opportunity was lost by the fight going to Saudi Arabia, and I think it's a real blow to DAZN. Mm.
So, going back to DAZN year one, if you were advising upper management there, John Skipper at DAZN, about how to look into year two and improve things, make it better, to take the next step in what this company wants to be, what would you say? You've been in that position running boxing at a major outlet.
We're the wild, wild west of sports. There is no commissioner. There's no single entity controlling it. You know, there'll never be one. I mean, a lot of people are going out there trying, you know, particularly you've seen it in recent years, people saying, I want to get out there. I'm going to try to take over the sport. No one can take over the sport. Okay? You have to be willing sometimes to let things go. You have to be willing to draw parameters and lines. At some point, what you pay for stuff matters. You know, I get the fact that money's being laid out as a loss leader, that you need to build a subscriber base. I see that totally. But you also have to say to yourself, at what point, when a Danny Jacobs gets paid $13 to $15 million to fight Canelo, I don't know the exact number, but it was sort of somewhere in that range from what I heard, that affects everything that goes after it. I mean, it also gets a guy like Keith Connolly, Manager of the Year. But at the same time, it has an impact on every deal and negotiation thereafter. You know, the inmates are sort of running the asylum a little bit in the sport right now. The guys way at the top are seeing that they have tremendous leverage out of the necessity of people to build businesses, you know? And I would say make the best fights you can make. Offer a consistency of quality. Quality control. I mean, you're streaming entire cards. You know, if the main event is what people tune in for and what they subscribe for, but the subscriber who's tuning into a card and it's Cowboys and Indians, you know, predetermined results for most of the stream for multiple hours, that's not a way to sell your service. There needs to be, I think there is a consistency of quality. I think that there are some very good fights on a regular basis, but I think there needs to be greater quality control and maybe holding the line a little bit and forcing people into situations. If a guy doesn't want to fight a fight you like, then don't put him on. It seems a little bit right now that there's a lot of people rolling around in crazy money, but not grateful enough or cognizant enough of the fact that the zone needs to offer an excellence of product with regularity. And if people are paying you multiples of the marketplace, then you should be willing to fight anybody on earth. We're in a business where the best are supposed to fight the best, but if you're being incented out the wazoo with incredible amounts of money, then you shouldn't have to have your arm twisted. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's a difficult situation also because there's a chicken and the egg situation if you're a streaming service, right? You need subs. So you need to get the biggest quality, the biggest product, the product that's most significant, the product that's going to make people subscribe. But until you have enough subscribers, major sports leagues, team sports, and they're going to be reticent to make deals until there's a sufficient enough base of subscribers. So I get it. There's a lot of pressure on the part of people running DAZN to bring in eyeballs, to bring in to get attention and to try to lift that sub base. Mm-hmm. You know, but at the same time, I mean, you know, boxing has a way, and this is one of the problems with the sport. And it's one of the problems when you don't have any central authority and you don't have any structure. We've always fucked around with the people. Every time some player comes in with a lot of bread, we like take their money, get as greedy as we possibly can, without paying enough attention to what these people need to do to sustain their business model.
It's totally different than other sports because in boxing, the deals cut. Promoters that they get cut with don't often act like partners. Whereas in the NBA or the NFL, once they cut a deal with the network, they act like partners.
But I'm amazed by what I'm watching. And again, this is not a product of me being a great guy. It's a product of me being a smart guy. If you're going to pay me more than anyone else is, I'm going to be a great fucking partner. If you're going to come to me, my fighters, my goal for my fighters is not to protect them from tough fights. It's to make them adequate living. It's to get them the highest paydays they can get so they can get out of this sport secure and healthy. It's all I care about, right? So I don't give a fuck about taking risk if you're paying me appropriately. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be a goddamn good partner, a really, really, really good partner if you're paying me top of the market. And I'm watching stuff going on that's suggesting to me, once again, that boxing shoots itself in the foot every opportunity it gets. So there's monopoly money out there. So grab as much of it as you can, but don't act like a good partner. Don't decrease the stress and anxiety on the part of the people you're doing business with. The anxiety, the stress on the guys now running DAZN to make the best quality product, it's not appropriate given the money they're spending. You would think the people they're in business with are bending over backwards to advance the agenda of the people paying top dollar. Mm-hmm. And I encountered this also at HBO because we were top dollar for most of the time I was there. But I got to be honest, on a lot of occasions, and I had years where I wouldn't do any business with King. Aram and I used to kill each other and then alternatively do a lot of business together. But there were times where I didn't buy anything for Aram for a year. Because it was like, if you don't want to do what I want you to do, if you don't want to give us the quality of product we want, then go elsewhere. You know, sometimes you have to use that kind of leverage. You can't always, I need this. And then the people you're negotiating with know you need something, so they twist your arm until your ligaments are tearing. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
No, you don't need anything badly enough to destroy your negotiating leverage and your business model. And I don't blame, you know, a guy like a Skipper is used to dealing with these league guys and whatever. Now he's in boxing and he's dealing with promoters and fighters and whatever. You're dealing with athletes that can walk down the street without being recognized and getting held up. I mean, by what rights is Sergey Kovalev making $10 million or close to it or over that? I mean, okay, if someone's willing to pay it, that's what the market is. But at the same time, I mean, insanity is prevailing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm happy to see a lot of money being spent in my sport, but I'm not seeing results that are or I'm not seeing fights being created and programs being developed that reflect the effort, time, money that are being put into them. And a lot of it is the fault of our industry, our sport.
Mm-hmm.
We have a long, long history of being money grabbers. That's our history. And by the way, I get it. I've been in that situation myself, because there's not a predictability in boxing the way there is in other sports. You know, you could have a superstar like a Tyson sitting on top of the sport, elevating the whole sport, and then that guy disappears, and then, you know, things change. You could have network TV out for a generation. Now it's back in, but on what basis? It probably came back in because of the affordability.
Mm.
You know, because we're low compared to team sports, to leagues, we're low cost sports programming. The amount of money being spent in boxing right now, and I don't want to be a downer. I'm not a downer. I'm still in this fucking industry. But realistically, why is all this money being spent? Not because we're on the rise, boxing isn't great. All these people try to convince you that boxing is killing it right now. Boxing's never been this healthy. Look at all the money. Oh, all you hardcore 200, all quarter million of you hardcore fans, you're getting boxing events every fucking day. Oh, how great boxing is right now. What great shape. No, man. No. It's because we're not that expensive. We're affordable. We're being overpaid on the highest levels right now. If you look at the results, there's not a rationality to the money being spent in our business right now. And if people really cared, if there was a commissioner and a league structure, and you know, people be sitting there going, okay, we're getting all this money right now. How do we keep it? Like, where are we going to be a year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now, 5 years from now?
Mm-hmm.
No one's doing that.
No, it's short-term thinking.
But it's short-term thinking, in my view, for what I'm watching, even on the part of the people that are being benefited the most. The guys that have these exclusivity and these big deals, they seem to be, you know, running all the way to the banks. But I don't see a lot of strategy going into where are we in 12 months, 24 months, 36 months, 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the way we're going right now, I have no clue. One of the few clues I do have, like looking at my own life, is I don't see myself 5 years from now sitting in the same place. Mm-hmm. or doing this podcast with you.
Yeah, you've been saying you'll be back on this podcast in 5 years.
Maybe. We'll see.
What are you kidding? I
have a love-hate with this shit, though, bro.
Of course you do. Yes. Yeah.
But so do you.
Of course I do.
Is it possible to be an intelligent, decent person working this industry without having a love-hate for it?
Yes.
In fact, it's probably impossible. Even if you're a piece of shit, you're going to have a love-hate with it.
How do you like the money part of it? Like, for example, you mentioned Kovalev there, and you know, 10 million, 11 million, whatever he's getting there. If you're DAZN and you need Canelo to fight before the end of the year, what do you do in a situation like that? If you're in that position, I mean, can you draw that line in the sand and say, we're not going over this amount of money, take it or leave it?
Yeah, maybe, probably. I would certainly have done it on some deal, and maybe that, I mean, there has to be at some point a line drawn in the sand. Because you're just because every negotiations affect other negotiations, and it becomes harder and harder to make bigger fights, and the expectations of people become crazy.
Look, can you put the toothpaste back in the tube? Like, say, going into next year, like the schedule is kind of what it is for the rest of the year. The all that money being spent, can you scale it back after you spend it? Can you put that proverbial toothpaste back in the tube?
It's hard, but to some extent you can. I mean, you're writing the checks, you're paying the dollars, you still have the leverage.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? I'd be more inclined to see if I'm a program. I was a programmer. I mean, my instincts are still a television guy in my head. I mean, that's what I started in boxing. That's what I spent the glory years of my career doing before I got into promoting. Mm. It's a completely different business. So I mean, my orientation was as a program acquirer, a programmer. If someone came in and said, "Well, you paid Danny Jacobs X number of dollars," I said, "I don't give a fuck. I made a mistake. I overpaid. I did what I needed to do then. I don't need to do that right now." You know, mm-hmm. You don't want to fight for $10 million? Go fight for $2 million on ESPN. I don't give a fuck. Mm-hmm. I don't need you. Tell someone you need them in boxing. They're going to bleed you, man. They're going to take every last ounce they can get out of you. You know, so, you know, I'm not telling people how to do their jobs, but, and what's also unfortunate is if you're in that position and you're the dude sitting there and you're the billionaire that's investing in the zone and your money's out there. You know, you shouldn't have to look at the people you're unjustifiably enriching exponentially and watch them just dig their hands deeper into your pocket without any seeming care for your success or failure. You know, this isn't something new in boxing. You've seen it happen so many times. New players come in, pick their pocket, they're out. Sorry, boxing, I'm gone. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that we create a lot of our own problems, and we look a lot of gift horses in the mouth. Mm. And boxing is its own worst enemy all the time.
What do you think of they're trying something different in November? They're going to do the rematch with KSI, Logan Paul, YouTube stars, and look, it will bring in a record number of subscribers.
They're a streaming service. People watch on devices. Mm-hmm. Okay, I don't like Logan Paul. I think he's a fucking asshole. My brother committed suicide. This guy took a fucking video in a suicide forest. I like to beat the shit out of him myself. Okay, I think the fight's a joke. I don't think it's a professional boxing match. It's irrelevant. A lot of people want to watch it. Mm-hmm. So if they want to put, if they're going to put it on DAZN and it's going to result in some millennials subscribing to DAZN, I get it. I don't hate anybody for doing it. I'm not criticizing Eddie for promoting it or criticizing DAZN for streaming it. I'm not, and I get it. Those guys are new media superstars. They're internet stars. You know what I mean? And if that's going to cause people to subscribe to DAZN, that's cool. If it works, it's going to create what's going to have to become regular niche programming for this. Not the last time. See, here's what people aren't concentrating on. And I don't care. I'm fine with it. If you give me, if I feel like I'm getting $10 of value a month, I don't give a fuck what I'm not watching. Mm-hmm. I feel the same way about regular TV. It's an awful lot of shit I would never watch. Okay? It doesn't mean other people, to each his own, man. I'm a libertarian when it comes to this shit. TV programming, I was a programmer. I'm definitely a libertarian when it comes to programming, right? So, but you know this, if this KR, with KR1, is that this fucking dude's name?
KSI.
KSI, the fuck it is, I don't know. Never, I don't even know who the fuck he is. I went on to his YouTube thing, he has a Caribbean accent, that's all I know about him. And the other guy, I know who he is, and I think he's a fucking a-hole.
A-hole is where you draw the line. that's where you draw the line in the curse word. Okay, continue.
If it works, you want to maintain that subscriber base you're adding because it worked. So you're going to see a lot more of it. And that's cool as long as it's not detracting from the stuff that makes me want to subscribe. Right?
Right.
So I got no problem with it. In a weird way, I don't like making believe it's real boxing. I don't like watching Big Dan Rayfield acting like this is some kind of boxing. But no, dude, it's two internet guys fighting.
And there could be an upside. I think there's an upside too. If you put,
no, you're not building an audience. That's bullshit. I don't give a fuck if you put the five best prospects in the history of boxing underneath. You're not making those guys stars because
not making them stars, but you'll be exposing them. We just spent a whole time talking about Anthony Joshua and the exposure there. If it's a million plus people watching these guys and they tune in, I know, but it's 20,000 people maybe at Staples Center.
I could go to Howard Stern's audience right now and I could promote one of his friggin' Wattpad, you know, like guys against someone he's having a feud with, and there's going to be an audience for it. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't mean, if I put a real fighter underneath, it's not going to change the idea. This whole, like, cut the bullshit, okay? We're doing it on its face. We're doing these two dudes who are internet stars, who are Instagram, YouTube, whatever they are, stars, because it's already proven there's a big audience for it, and it's already proven people will pay $10 for it, and if you put it on and it works, then you do more of it, and people hold their subscription because they're getting what they want to see. But it's got nothing to do with building a boxing one. It's got nothing to do with boxing. To be honest with you, I'm not even sure it helps conceptually to make believe it is. No, it's you know what I'm saying?
Like, I get what you're saying, but I also I disagree to the extent that there's some kind of upside to people watching you that wouldn't watch you otherwise.
But what are they watching, dude? I mean, with all due respect, most of the boxing undercard sucks. So I barely watch it myself. But let's face realities. When I buy a pay-per-view, I'm buying the main event.
Right.
Okay?
Most
of it. And I hate to say this, but I've been looking at the undercards of some of the major shit that's coming lately. It's the worst shit I've ever seen. And we do this. Here's another way. I say boxing is its own worst enemy. You're having the biggest audiences you have. You have a main event that's great. You don't give people, force-feed people puke. Are you fucking nuts? It's not expensive to make a good fight. It's not expensive to make a fight that people at the arena care about, that people will buy tickets for. It's not expensive to attract fans to actually come into the arena so it looks like you have a major event. I got news for you guys, and John Skipper should hear me on this too. If you can't bring people into the arena, you're not getting people to subscribe. You know what I'm saying? Yep. So, it can't hurt. You know, yeah, okay, if there's a bunch of millennials that are going to watch the show and you stick Devin Haney on it or someone, they see him, can't hurt. But don't feed me the line of BS that it's going to build a boxing audience.
No.
Boxing can't build a boxing audience. Two fucking internet dudes fighting each other who don't look like they ever took a boxing lesson are gonna build a boxing audience? No.
No, but I would probably, you mentioned Devin Haney, I think that if he wins on Friday, he'll be on that card, and I would put my youngest guys on there to try to connect.
No, the guy that should be on the card, and I don't know if he's going to be because he's not with Eddie. He's with Golden Boy, but Golden Boy's also with DAZN. It's Ryan Garcia because he's a fucking internet star.
Yeah,
I love the kid. By the way,
I agree.
I love Ryan Garcia. I really do. I love him because he gets it.
Millions of Instagram.
I don't
followers.
Think he's the best fighter in the world. I don't think he's right. I mean, he's a young kid. I mean, can he become great? Yeah, sure. I mean, he's got plenty of time. But is he right now? No. I mean, can I knock him off in 20 ways? Mm-hmm. But can he become a great fighter? Yeah. Is he already a savvy, smart kid that gets self-marketing? Tremendously so. That should be embraced. He, in a lot of ways, is an actual prize fighter with the mentality of the guys like Logan Paul and that whatever the dude. Was it KR1?
KSI.
I don't know who the fuck he is. KSI. I don't know. I mean, what KSI, KRI, K.
Okay, that's
KTLA. I don't know who he is.
That's a station out there.
All right, whatever.
That's a TV station.
The fuck do I know?
All right. Let's move on for a second. Friday night. I want to talk about the women's boxing. You've been a big advocate for it.
By the way,
eventually.
I'm just going to interrupt one second. I come on with a guy like you, and I think we know each other a long time. We have these conversations off the air. I say the same things on this mic, on your podcast, that I would say if we're talking privately. There's so much smoke and bullshit in boxing right now. So much of what you read is nonsense. And the press corps, you know, there are exceptions. There are legitimate people who get it, who've been around it a long time. Right now, anybody with an iPhone or a mic or a tape recorder is a pundit or a... People don't know what the hell is going on. And most of what you read and see is spin, you know? At some point, you got to stop spinning and look at reality.
All right. We'll take that for what it's worth there. So on Friday, the co-main on DAZN will be the women's featherweight title. Your fighter, Heather Hardy, Amanda Serrano, two of your fighters. Hardy and Serrano are both New Yorkers. They have sold the lion's share of the tickets for this event, but neither will make the kind of money that men would in the same type of situation. Heather told Kevin Ioli over at Yahoo that the pay gap in boxing is blatantly, disgustingly bad. Do you agree with her?
Yes, but even though I am the biggest proponent on earth for Heather Hardy, the biggest proponent on earth for Amanda Serrano, you're not going to hear me screaming for pay equality. Pay fairness, though? Yeah.
What does that mean? What's the difference?
I mean, it shouldn't be 15, 20 cents on the dollar. It shouldn't be. I mean, Devin Haney's a great, great, great prospect, but in all likelihood, he's making 8 to 10 times for this fight against some guy whose name I don't even know. And it hasn't sold a ticket. And I think Devin Haney's a great prospect and a good kid. And I think he's going to be a boxing star. And I'm not arguing that the girls have to make what Devin's making. But the idea that they sold all the tickets, it's not only all the tickets. Look at the media impressions. I mean, the articles have all been written about the women's fight. The local media in the New York area has all been about the women's fight. And by far, the fight on the card that's gotten the most attention is the women's fight. You know, why are they getting paid what they are? Because no one has to pay them more. It's a career-high payday for both of them. And there's no real champion among any media outlet or streaming service or network for women's boxing. You know, I said something about kicking the door open at the press conference. I mean, I thanked the Zone for... I thanked the Zone for opening the door at the Zone. I thanked Eddie for opening the door at the Zone. But I said the door needs to be kicked down, you know? I'm not ignoring the fact Showtime's done some stuff for women, but really, what have they done? They're in the Clarissa Shields business. They're not in the women's boxing business. They're not even building Clarissa's opponents. Alicia Napoleon has the whole package. Looks, smarts, great interview, exciting style, strong punch, looks like Wonder Woman. She's a natural big fight for Clarissa in the future. She can't get on Showtime. Showtime's not building opponents for Clarissa. They're in the Clarissa business. Bob Arum at ESPN, they're not in the women's boxing business. The Michaela Mayer business. You know what I mean? So, like, grabbing one woman doesn't mean you're supporting female boxing. And do I think that these women deserve to make what the men are making? I'm not saying that. It's WNBA players clearly don't quote-unquote deserve to make what the male NBA players are making. It's just it's supply, demand, this economic principle involved, you know? But fairness, you know, fairness.
Mm-hmm.
Should the purses in a perfect world... And do I believe in the future the purses would be higher for women in this level of fight? Do I think the next iteration in 5 years, the next Amanda Serrano fighting the next Heather Hardy should make more money? Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Do I think in a perfect world these women should have been paid more for this fight? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? You got to be thankful for steps in the right direction. It's still a career high payday for both of them.
Mm-hmm.
It's still the fact that it gathered all this attention. That's got to be in the, you know, I would think the people at the Zone are noticing that. I mean, I would think that media guys and people are noticing that. PR people are noticing that. I mean, it's gotten a lot of attention.
Hmm.
It says to you that women in the right circumstances can get a lot of attention in boxing.
It feels like the building of a fight is applicable here because we have been building towards, you know, if Amanda wins on Friday, Amanda versus Katie Taylor. That has been marinating for a while now. And that would be...
And ironically, if Heather Hardy wins, it's not like the fight's any smaller.
No.
Could you imagine if Heather Hardy pulled
an upset?
If she
can beat Amanda Serrano, that would be, you fight, do that fight in New York.
Huge.
You know, Katie's Irish,
that's
popular.
A main event.
She's popular.
That's a main event.
Yeah.
Serrano, by the way, either one, Katie and Serrano, Katie and Heather, those are main event fights.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Do you think there's a trial balloon to be done, though? Because I would guess that one of the reasons that they're not paid as much is because there's the assumption they're not going to draw an audience as strong. They can sell tickets, but you know there's a difference between the audience.
No, I get it, but you know what? And this is, look, again, I don't want to shit on my own sport, but how many of our champions, how many guys are out there making $1 million or more a fight that can't draw flies to a garbage dump even in their hometown?
Mm-hmm.
It's a rarity that you see guys that are big draws even where they live. You know? And I'm not going to get into denigrating people and mentioning who they are, but you can go through the whole list of fighters in boxing, and the overwhelming majority of them can't sell out an arena in their hometown.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, let's stop.
And whose fault? Is that on the promoters?
No, it's on.
It's got to be on the promoters.
A little bit.
Yeah.
It's a little bit on the promoters. It's also a little bit on the TV executives.
I mean, you've had people that have sold tickets, but you also had, I mean, I remember Andre Berto couldn't sell any tickets down there.
There's a lot of people that couldn't sell tickets. I mean... Hey, but here's another thing, too. There's got to be a realization on the part of media executives that if the event's not selling in the room, why would you think it's going to sell on TV? Or conversely, look at it in a more positive light. Something that's selling big time in the room has a great chance to catch fire on a streaming service or on a television network.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's all supply and demand.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, if something's selling in New York, this is still fucking New York.
Mm.
You know, as goes New York, there's a lot of truth to that, you know?
Mm. Do you think a women's card should happen? I mean, let's say Amanda Serrano, if she wins, it's hypothetically, against Katie Taylor. You could do two undercards of whomever. Maybe you can get Clarissa Shields to come over for a fight. Maybe you can get Michaela Mayer to come over for a fight. How would a fight like that do? Not in terms of sales and tickets, but in terms of ratings or on TV or on DAZN.
Well, in terms of ratings on a TV, I think
for a television executive, you never talk into the microphone. You know that, right? You never actually talk into the microphone.
If you're on a basic cable broadcast network, premium cable network, and you make a big enough main event, you're going to bring an audience. Okay? On a streaming service, you're really selling the main event, right? So if you have a main event that's going to be, if you have something you're going to stream as a main event, there's no reason not to do an all-women's card. Mm. And by the way, for a fraction of the amount of money that I would that would be paid to have a star male boxer, and I use the term star loosely, $1 million plus male boxer in a main event, for the cost of that, I can make a four-fight card of female unification bouts, guaranteeing you that every bout is a brawl. And I personally think that's going to be good programming, whether you're streaming it or you're televising it, you know? And by the way, let's extend that into men. You know, you're creating product. Boxing After Dark built a reputation, an audience, a brand by making great fights. Wasn't household names. It was great fights. You know, if you have a series of fights where you know they're evenly matched and every fight's going to be a brawl, promote that, because that will draw people in.
Isn't that what Showbox is supposed to be?
You know, you can't be that for $50,000 to $100,000 a show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you, I mean, and by the way, you also can't do that only doing business with one or two promoters. You know, but I've always been a fan of the Showbox series. I'm a fan of a developmental series of young fighters. Mm-hmm. I actually think that it's a good idea for an ESPN Plus or a DAZN. Look, it's hard to build stars on a streaming service, mm-hmm. but it's cost effective to build your own talent. And to create a
That's what NBC Sports Network did for a while, with the guys that eventually went on to HBO, with Kathy's guy, Curtis Stevens, Sergey Kovalev.
Yeah, but it's a lot more sensible when it's your own network. You're gonna
For example, if
you sit there and you create a $250,000 level of take let's be realistic, okay, a small fight, you're doing a two or triple headers in a developmental series, you're streaming four or five fights, $250,000 budget. And you open it up to every promoter in the industry, but the one thing you get is future rights of exclusivity.
Mm-hmm.
If you're investing the money to pay the young fighter more than he's going to get elsewhere, give guys an opportunity to get paid regularly where they're not getting it elsewhere, and they commit to you that you have the right, if you want, to continue to televise them, you're developing your own talent on a cost-effective basis. You don't have to go out and get held up by some aging Russian fighter with a less than stellar personal history, you know, to pay them arguably four to five times of what they're worth. Develop your own talent if you have a long-term picture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there has to be a balancing act too. You know, you need to do the level of programming that's going to cause eyeballs to come to you immediately and bring subscribers, but you need to maintain those subscribers, and you need that. If you're looking to maintain that level of programming in the future, you can't always do it by paying monopoly money.
Mm-hmm.
You have to make some investment in the future and create some economic paradigm that's normal, that's economically sound, and gives you an opportunity realistically to not have the bubble burst.
Mm-hmm. Lastly, you've got a fighter in Tevin Farmer that's been extremely active, defended his world title. You know, there was some talk of Gervonta Davis fight. David Davis obviously says he's moving up to 135. Jojo Diaz is going to fight on September 21st, I guess, on Facebook in Mexico, probably a low-level fight. But what do you do? You know, you talk about fighters that need
We fought who we were asked to fight. I think that he was served incredibly well by fighting five fights in a year. How many people do that? Five title fights in a year. He's ready for the big fights right now. The Gervonta's moved up to 35. We're at 30, two different platforms.
Mm-hmm. Did you think that fight was going to happen?
No.
All the back and forth?
No, there wasn't all the back. First of all, there wasn't that much back and forth.
There was Eddie saying $5 million.
For whatever, I can talk to him, and I can talk to Leonard. They're friends of mine. I mean, well, they're people that I've done business with for a long time, and we have very cordial and positive relationships, you know, in terms of our ability to communicate. Did I think the fight was going to happen right now? No, I knew that there was a I knew what was had been offered to Gervonta to cross the street and come to the zone. I knew what they had offered us. They weren't going to take our offer, and we weren't going to take theirs.
But is that not insane?
No,
that,
not really.
Like, is Davis going to get $5 million in his next
fight? I don't
know
what he's going to get. I really don't.
Do you think he's going
to
get?
I don't know, man. There's so much funny money being paid and irrationality. Hey, look, there are fights that I don't even understand how people watch, where people are getting paid seven figures to participate in. So I don't know what he's going to get. I'm not counting.
Davis turned down he turned down $5 million. That to me is insane, because he goes into a fight, and Tevin's a good fighter, but I would make Gervonta a favorite in that fight coming.
He's not leaving the PBC universe right now. Period. And by the way, I'll be honest, if they came to the table and they said $3.5 million, $4 million, or came close to what I know the kind of money Gervonta was offered, it would have been a whole different, there would have been a negotiation. Mm-hmm. When they came in at $2 million and they had been offered $5 million, I don't care. I don't give a shit what people made in the past. I don't care that Gervonta never made as much as $5 million. I don't care that Tevin never made $2 million. Okay? When one side said, come across the street for $5 million, and the other one said, come across the street for $2 million, the fight wasn't happening.
Okay, but how is this different than what the argument you just made at the top of this podcast, where you just said there's got to be a line that you draw on money? Tevin has never made $2 million. Like, and they're
here's the thing, too.
They're doing what you said
I'll be honest with you. I'm trying to be a good partner. I mean, we did some fights with Eddie. Okay, Eddie has been, I got to be honest with you, Eddie is so thinly spread, it's impossible to get the fucker on the phone. Like, even when we're in the same city, Eddie's out there. Eddie's probably somewhere in this building right now doing an interview with some guy I never saw or heard of, who's got an iPhone, who would put it in front of Eddie, and Eddie will talk to these people for 7 hours, but I can't get him on the phone. Do you know what I mean? But that being said, like, I think he deserves an opportunity if a big fight can be delivered. The Zone's money has paid Tevin. If the Zone produces a big fight for Tevin and the right money, I think they deserve an opportunity for us to stay where we are. I'm trying to be a good partner to the Zone, honestly, because I need to be. I need future money to flow from the Zone to my fighters. I need opportunities for my fighters to fight on the Zone. And ideally, I don't really want in the future, if I have the right fighter, to have to go through Eddie or Golden Boy. Mm. You know, so I want to be a good partner to the Zone. And by the way, Tevin understands what loyalty is, and he also understands opportunity. Tevin wants to fight JoJo Diaz. He's wanted that fight for a long time. Now, I don't think JoJo fighting some pedestrian guy in September in Mexico, really on Facebook, means he can't fight Tevin Farmer before year end. So I don't view that at all as something that's negating the possibility of Farmer Diaz. But I'll tell you this, take Farmer Diaz, put it in Philadelphia with a great undercard, you have an event. And it's a great fight. Stylistically, it's a great fight. Because mm-hmm. JoJo Diaz will bring the fight to Tevin's face. And as you know, Tevin's a boxer, but he's not a runner. Mm-hmm. So that fight can't be a bad fight.
I think it's an excellent fight.
It's a great fight.
If that fight can be made in November.
And I believe that fight can be made for November, December. Mm. You know?
There are options on this side of this, and I know people say hate this phrase, this side of the street, but you know, you got Cancio out there, who is, you know, a great story.
Here's
certainly
the other thing, by the way. Just realistic, I'm a promoter. Okay? I don't bullshit people. I mean, I'll explain to people what the game's about. Now that Gervonta Davis has moved up to 35, going forward, if Tevin's still at 30 and maintaining his belt at 30, and we take a shot at a 35, like, I would love to fight Lomachenko with Tevin at 35, and that's not at the Zone. Bob Arum called me. I mean, Tevin and Lomachenko have sparred a lot of rounds in the past. They know mm-hmm. each other. And Tevin has, you know, Lomachenko knows Tevin can fight, and if we got the opportunity to move up to 35 to fight Lomachenko,
one way to get Lomachenko too is if you collect belts at 130. If he cleans up at 135 and comes back down.
Well, look, I would love to fight Cancio. I would love to fight Burchelt. Those aren't happening for a reason. Mm-hmm. I'd love to. You know, I called Arum and said, "You wanna, you know, if there was enough money, would Herring fight off of ESPN?" No. Now, if there's enough money, would we go to ESPN? But I don't think there'd be enough. I don't think that there would be that kind of money. I also think that from a standpoint of promotability and selling tickets, that in some ways a JoJo Diaz fight might be every bit as big or bigger than a fight with Herring, even though I love the kid. Mm. You know, he's a good guy. He's a former Marine, a really good person. But there's no question in my mind that even though that's a unification, a JoJo Diaz fight based upon the appeal to the West Coast fans, the Mexican-American fans, you know, Tevin's fan base, East West, the whole thing stylistically. I think that the JoJo Diaz fight's a pretty big fight.
Yeah, I think it's a good fight, too. Lou, always appreciate it, man. By the way, at the beginning you said that was my last F-bomb. You dropped 9 by my count after that. So, and then you drew the line at a-hole, which I find incredible. Like, you're just going to – that's too a bridge too far
it's
for
true.
You, the a-hole.
You know what? I don't really understand. You know, I do that a lot. I don't even understand that. I'll drop the F-bomb, but I instinctively say a-hole. I don't
Lou, always appreciate it.
Thank you, man.
All right, Devin Haney is here, 135-pound contender. The Dream, fighting Friday night, Madison Square Garden, Hulu Theater. The Dream nickname, where'd it come from?
The Dream nickname came when I was younger. Somebody just gave it to me, and it pretty much just stuck with it.
Was there a runner-up, like a second nickname that you might have gone with?
It was a lot like that just came over time. New Money came, Superman came, but The Dream, which is the first one, so a lot of people just knew me as Devin the Dream.
New Money, that have anything to do with Mayweather?
I mean,
it would have worked pretty well.
Like, at that time, New Money, the new Blue Money came out, and it was just something that somebody gave to me.
The influence that Mayweather had on your life. I mean, I know you moved to Vegas at a young age. You worked out with his father for a little bit. How would you describe the influence he's had over you?
He had a lot of influence. He motivated me a lot in the sport. You know, me just being able to, you know, be around him so much. And, you know, he was basically like, you know, coming up, being around, you know, someone like Michael Jordan, but actually being able to, you know, touch them, you know, be able to talk to them, be able to, you know, call them up whenever, you know. So he had a lot of influence. He motivated me a lot.
Were you able to kind of contact him, like, whatever?
Yeah,
was it like that?
Was
that kind of relationship?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. We had that kind of relationship. You know, he was always somebody who, you know, was like a mentor, somebody who I could, you know, call for any type of info.
What's the best piece of advice he gave you as a boxer?
He gave me a lot of advice. He always just tells me to stay focused. Like every time I talk to him, he always tells me, you know, just stay focused. You know, I have a bright future, and if I just stay focused, you know, the world is mine.
Did he give you any advice on kind of handling the everything that goes into boxing beyond the fighting? Because look, you're here on a fight week doing probably, I think, your 97th interview of this week. Did he give you any advice on how to handle all that?
He gave me a lot of advice on, you know, just like marketing myself and, selling fights, just a lot of gems that, you know, that you couldn't buy.
Mm-hmm. So your dad's your trainer, and I'm always interested in the father-trainer relationship. How do you separate, you know, the father from the trainer? How do you do that?
A lot of dads in the sport of boxing, they don't know how to separate that, you know, and that's one thing I commend my dad on. You know, it's not just a one-sided thing. You know, with my dad, you know, we talk about everything, but I also have my own opinion, and he respects my opinion, you know, as me being a fighter, you know, as me being in the ring, he always respects my opinion. So it's never really, you know, any type of confusion or any, we don't really have butt like that, because you know, it's a lot of respect in our relationship.
Has it ever crossed over where it's like, Dad, you know, you're being my father, whereas you're supposed to be my trainer, or vice versa?
Of course, you know, we're human, and you know, sometimes I'll be like, you know, Dad, you being kind of extra right now. Dad, all right, calm down, you know. And like I said, you know, he respects it, you know, and I appreciate him for that, because, you know, some dads, they want to be, you know, just like hardcore all the time, and the son doesn't get, you know, that their say. But, you know, when I tell him, like, Dad, all right, I understand, Dad, I heard you the first time. Like today, I was doing something, making weight, and he kept telling me something, and I said, Dad, I heard you the first time, okay? And he said, okay, son, all right.
So you're a young kid growing up, and you're like everyone else, from what I understand, dreaming of making the Olympics, playing, competing in the Olympics. What changed that for you?
Well, when they changed the age on the Olympics from 17 to 19, that's when I realized I couldn't go. I was fighting overseas. I was, you know, training at the Olympic Training Center. I was, you know, preparing for the Olympics. But when they changed the age on it, I realized that I, you know, basically couldn't go. So it was like, should I wait into the Olympics after that, or should I just go pro? And that's what I did.
It's tough. That's a tough decision, right? Because I mean, part of you probably has an Olympic dream. The other part is like, I'm gonna turn pro, make some money, and be a professional.
Yeah, the Olympic dream, that was always a dream for me. Like I said, I had 138 amateur fights. I fought maybe 20, 30 times, you know, overseas. So I was preparing for the Olympics. So when I got the news, it was like, you know, it was heartbreaking. But, you know, everybody has their own paths. Everyone can't be an Olympic, you know, star or anything like that. And I'm happy that I did turn pro, you know, at a young age, because I wouldn't be here in this situation if I didn't.
You know, some of these young guys turn pro, they do it on big cards in Vegas on the low undercard. You go to Tijuana, and you spend the first four fights of your professional career, was eight of the first 10, fighting in Tijuana. What was that experience like?
You're definitely right. A lot of prospects out of the amateurs, they go and they sign with huge promoters, and they fight on big cards, and they get paid pretty good coming out of the amateurs. Mm-hmm. Me, I didn't. You know, I went to Tijuana. I was fighting for free. I was fighting in bars, you know, where the whole crowd was against me.
What's the craziest venue you fought at early in your career that you remember?
A bar, literally. I was like, it was literally a bar. Like, it was all around. It was a bar with a ring inside the middle. You know, I didn't fight at a gymnasium, with bleachers and stuff like that. I didn't fight at some pretty crazy places, but it all prepared me for now.
Why Tijuana? Obviously, you can fight in Mexico at a younger age, but mm-hmm. could you have gone overseas to Europe?
I could have went, you know, some other places. I overseas. I could have went to like Mississippi and some places like that. But
Tijuana, Mississippi.
Tijuana, which is convenient. It was right there next to San Diego. So we found out how to get fights out there. And that's pretty much it, which is easier.
Mm-hmm. When you're in that situation, you're trying to build up your record. But, you know, I would imagine fighting in Tijuana in Mexico, you got to be a little worried about judging and how things are going to shake out. I mean, did you have to win the thing like, I got to stop, or at least if I got to win decisively or stop these guys?
Yeah, I was definitely, you know, going in, I was really nervous. A lot of people was telling me bad things about Mexico. They were telling me that, you know, it was that they're gonna rob me of a decision. They're corrupt. Everyone is against me. It was just telling me all different kind of stories. So I would go in there and I would just go for the kill, because they said, you know, if a guy would even get close to you, the crowd would go crazy. I didn't know if the judge would just stop the fight, even if a guy just even got close to hitting me, or if they hit me with a good shot or anything like that. So I just would train to dominate.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever experience that in the fight, like where a guy hit you and you're like, I gotta come back quickly or else this referee's gonna
I would go in there and I would just be on my A game. Like I said, I wouldn't let the guy get close to hitting me.
You again, a lot of top prospects, they sign with a top promoter right away, they build themselves up that way. You decided to start Devin Haney Promotions and be independent. Now, we've seen that work somewhat. I mean, Saddam Ali did it for a little while. Other guys, it didn't really work out for. Why did you decide to do that, and how did it work for you?
Coming out of amateurs, I did have some, you know, big deals, but it wasn't the biggest type of deals. And the offers that I was getting when I first came out of the amateurs, I said, well, if they're offering me this when I'm 2-3-0 or 0-0, imagine when I'm 15-0 or 20-0. You know, I pretty much just trusted in the process. I started my own promotion. Excuse me. And I just started getting my own fights, and pretty much I got to the point to where I could pretty much fluctuate my deal, and make a deal make sense, you know, for me to sign.
It does make sense. It's smart in a way, because you probably did get a much better offer from Eddie Hearn than you got when you were 17, 18
definitely,
years old.
Definitely.
In that way. The Showbox opportunity, that was kind of your breaking out point. And you got it as an independent without having someone. How did that opportunity come about?
I was pretty much a promoter, and the guys who they were offering me to fight, I wouldn't say I went in my first fight. I fought a guy named Mason Menard. He was pretty much knocking guys out cold. He was like 30-1 or 30-2 or some or something like that, and I was 19-0. I pretty much haven't fought anybody, you know, close to his caliber. So I went in there pretty much on, I wouldn't say the B side, but pretty much on the B side. It was a 50-50 fight, and it was the main event. I went straight to the main event, you know, on Showbox. I didn't, you know, fight on an opener or anything like that. I fought, you know, I went straight to the main event, and I took the fight, and I went in the fight, and I just dominated, and that's pretty much how I got on Showbox. Mm.
What made you decide that it was time to sign with a major promoter? Was it made you feel like that was the time?
You know, I felt like I was ready for the biggest of the biggest fights, and pretty much Matchroom, Eddie Hearn, you know, they offered me a deal I pretty much couldn't turn down, and they were willing to work with me and you know, and my team, Devin Haney Promotions. So everything just made sense.
What was it like being 20 years old and having, like, all these guys coming at you, the top promoters, yeah, and throwing some real dollars out there?
It was a blessing, you know. It was a dream come true. You know, I worked hard for it. It showed that, you know, my hard work paid off, and yeah.
Mm-hmm. You're 20 years old, and you're already calling out Lomachenko. People follow you on social media. You're, you know, subtweeting, you know, stories where Bob Arum's saying, I'm not, you know, Devin Haney doesn't do anything for Lomachenko. I hear a lot of guys say they can beat Lomachenko. What, and nobody has, except for early in his career, but what makes you believe that your style is a fit against a guy that is clearly one of the best in the world?
You know, I'm the type of fighter that comes around, you know, every 10 years or so. And I feel like my style, you know, my speed, my ring IQ, my style, it just tailor-made, you know. I feel like Lomachenko hasn't fought a guy, you know, what my type of style. Mm.
We're sitting here talking on the day of your weigh-in, making 135. How has it been for you, and how long do you think you can do it?
135 is not easy for me to make. I've been saying this for, you know, the last few months or so. Excuse me. It takes a lot of sacrifice, but like I said, I'll stay here long enough. You know, if I can, you know, get a big fight. If not, I move up to 140. You know, where it's easier for me to make. And but we'll see what happens. You know, I'm willing to stay at 135. You know, as long as I can to make a big fight happen.
Last thing I want to ask you is, you know, one thing I think that's good about boxing in the future is that there are a lot of guys around your age that are, like, really good and really entertaining, and in and around your weight class too. I mean, you got Ryan Garcia, who's going to fight on Saturday, Teofimo Lopez, who will probably have a chance or may have a chance to win the undisputed 135-pound championship. Virgil Ortiz up there at 147. Do you keep an eye on those guys that you know are going to be in your neighborhood?
Of course,
and
yeah.
What they're doing?
All those guys are doing very well, and you know, I like those guys. They're young like me, and they're the future of boxing. So, you know, I like and I respect those guys. And, you know, hopefully one day we can make a big fight happen.
Out of the guys I mentioned, anyone that you're most looking forward to fighting down the line?
I think all of them, you know, it can be a mega fight with all of them. You know, if any of them keep on winning, you know, we can make any of those fights. I think the fight that the fans really would want to see is me and Ryan Garcia, though. Mm.
I kind of want to see you and Teofimo.
Yeah.
I think that'd be a lot of swagger in that
the
fight.
The core boxing fans, you know, they want to see me and Teofimo, yeah. But, you know, the outsiders and the people who really don't know about boxing, they want to see me and Ryan Garcia.
I think any one of those would be a great fight. Appreciate the time, man. Thanks for joining me. Good luck on Friday night.
Thank you.